Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney, Chair with the Club's Business and Leadership Forum, and your host for today's program, which is entitled Makers of Innovation. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, to learn more about the fine program events that are here at the club. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Dale Doherty, in conversation with Robert Stevens. Dale is the founder and CEO of Maker Media. He's the creator of Make Magazine and International Maker Faire. Personally, I'm also a maker, participating in the Bay Area Maker Faire. I got to receive the Sustainability Award this year for my kombucha brewing kits. Are there lots of other makers in the room? Hands are going up. From its start in 2006, Maker Faire has grown to 151 Maker Faires held around the world. Dale is an author and was editor and co-founder of the technology publisher O'Reilly Media. Dale's most recent book, which I hope you will take advantage of acquiring tonight, is called Free to Make: How the Maker Movement is Changing Our Schools, Our Jobs, and Our Minds. Dale acts as a tour guide to the spectacular, hope-filled global phenomenon that we now call the Maker Faire. In 2011, he was honored at the White House as Champion of Change, honoring Americans who are doing, quote, extraordinary things in their communities to out-innovate, out-educate, and out-build the rest of the world. At the 2014 White House Maker Faire, President Obama introduced him as an American innovator making significant contributions to the fields of education and business. Dale will be speaking with Robert Stevens. Robert formed the original Geek Squad with $200 in 1994. In 2011, Geek Squad acquired Best Buy and opened Geek Squad precincts in all of the Best Buy properties worldwide. I think there were over 24,000 agents. The Geek Squad is now the world's largest technology support company. Robert served as CTO for Best Buy until 2012, when he relocated to San Francisco with his family to pursue his next startup. In 2016, Robert co-founded Assist, a secure messaging platform to power businesses and allow customers and employees to message each other. And now I would like to introduce Dale and Robert. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome. We're going to be talking about makers and geeks and other things like that. I'm really happy to be joined by Robert. We've had some good conversations in the past, and I thought we would just try to show this on a stage and put a couple microphones and see if that doesn't affect us too much. I think one of the interesting connections in some ways is that we've both sort of been in the business of organizing geeks. When I started Make Magazine in 2005, when I was working on the idea, I told Tim O'Reilly it was Martha Stewart for Geeks as a magazine. And I was always kind of interested in what certain people knew that not everybody knew, you know, how they figured out how to solve a problem, what they did that they enjoyed was sometimes different than other people. And I think in many ways they, when I started using the term maker to identify them, I saw them as in some ways a group of outsiders who weren't like everybody else, but I think knew things and tried to do things that many of us could do if we had some encouragement and some support. And I think I wrote the book somewhat to talk about this about dozen-year history of Make Magazine, and particularly Maker Faire, and give you some idea about, you know, some of the things I've seen. Last weekend I was in Chengdu, China, for a Maker Faire there, the first one. And Chengdu is like the fourth largest city in China. It's kind of like Houston is in America, which means it's not near the capital. It's not really on either west or east coast. It is, but it's an industrious city, an old city, a beautiful city in ways. Although I couldn't see a lot of it because it was very smoggy, but Maker Faire was held in a former factory that was in the 1950s and 1960s was building cathode ray tubes, televisions, in early days. And it was now called, in English, on the signs, Eastern Suburb Memory, and an awkward use of memory, perhaps. But it was kind of interesting. Some of the signs said that they wanted to fondly remember their industrial past, and it was being turned into shops and other, you know, restaurants and things as well. But many of the signs of that past were still around, a locomotive, some of the things that were made there, engines, and even a couple of statues commemorating some of the workers there. And I think in many ways we are in this post-industrial era where we look back on that period of factories and things differently. And sadly, we also wonder, you know, what are the things that we can make today? What are the things that almost every American city and probably other cities around the world defined itself by what it made, what it was known for? There's a great, I have never been to Trenton, New Jersey. Its motto is Trenton makes and the world takes. But, you know, you'll find a city like, I think it's Hartford, you know, they made hats there. They made something. And a lot of times those industries have gone. Sometimes they're still there in some forms. So another thing has kind of intrigued me is sort of what does the maker movement mean for cities? And this is in another book that we just came out with late called Maker City, a practical guide for reinventing our cities. And looking at some of the this book is more about the personal side of why we make and things. The Maker City is looking at some of the implications politically, community-wise, for how do we get together to look at manufacturing in cities again, to look at how we educate our children. And I kind of want to give a brief, and then I'm going to ask Robert to sort of give us a little bit of background on himself and the Geek Squad. But some of the things I try to ground in Free to Make is I think there's sort of three concepts to get across. Is making is a kind of play. It's when I started thinking about it and seeing people, it was something they did for fun. They enjoyed it, and I thought if I could make that available to people and understand that it's something fun, they'll do more of it. And many ways, it's the freedom to learn and the joy of learning. It's freedom to experiment and try things without worrying about the end result. And that's kind of one of the big differences between work and play is you don't have to be right. You don't have to know where you're going. And I think even in this context, one of the ideas I had when I started the magazine in looking at a lot of geeks who I thought played with technology. They played to discover what it could do. They played to discover what they could do with it and what they wanted to do. Is they really didn't know where they were going. What they wanted to do was immerse themselves in that and learn as much as they could, and then they would identify problems and see situations that they might have a new idea on. But they would never have had those ideas, never been able to solve those problems if they hadn't immersed themselves in this playful way. So I think sometimes we have in our heads a planning model, like we plan to go somewhere, we have a business idea, and that's what we try. And I think to some degree, making is this sense of iteration, of starting with an idea, whatever gets you started to make something, to do something, and then just keep at it and try it differently and see where it goes. I define making as in some ways this just having an idea that you can develop somehow using tools and materials, and eventually you can show that thing that you make to someone else. And both that process and that result of sharing are very satisfying. It's very human. It's something we can all do. And I think of the second concept to get across is making is a kind of practice. And we might talk about sports, music. You get better by doing it. And I think it's less important of whether you're innately good at doing it, as more as are you willing to practice? Are you willing to learn? Are you willing to try to do things without necessarily knowing whether you're good at it or not? And third is, and I think this is probably the newer dimension of making today, is it's about participation. Just is, think about being on a sports team or being in an orchestra motivates you to play your instrument or to learn your sport. Today, I think we can see a lot more social forms of making, whether it's robotics clubs or other things at, say, a makerspace, that provides social networks, social support for what you're doing. So you're not a lone tinkerer. You're a social tinkerer. You work with other people. And you can, because of the internet, connect and see what lots of people are doing around the world and connect around your interests, different tools and technologies, and go from there. And so but I think it, overall, this creates a kind of mindset that I write about in the book, a maker mindset. And I think that's the most value. And we might talk about in a religion almost how you might do a practice and you might study something, you might work at it. But it's who you become as well as the impact of you on the world that matters. And to some degree, this mindset develops out of the practice, not because we study it as a concept, but because we do these things, we begin to think that we can change things around us. We know how things work, and we can adapt. And so it's been really my goal to help spread that as an idea and even as a philosophy, but in practice to see people doing it. I think we... through Maker Faires, actually, to correct Elizabeth, we have about 191 Maker Faires this year around the world, and it's pretty amazing to visit them in different places and different cultures and see people, I think, connect on this human level. But I think one of the biggest impacts it's having today is in education, where this idea of hands-on learning is being reintroduced, of experiential learning, of doing rather than just knowing. And many thinkers that in the past, maybe 100 years ago, John Dewey had the phrase learning by doing. And there were Seymour Papert and others that talked about constructivism and the idea of to make knowledge. It was an act of creation. It wasn't like just absorbing ideas. You had to work at it. You had to struggle with it. So it's as though all of those good ideas were marginalized from education and moved somewhat out into informal education, like something you do outside of school. My guess is in the past, these were things you did normally in your life. And then school kind of connected the practical up to the theoretical, and it made sense. If you look at sort of the golden age of engineers, they were farm kids. They grew up in factory families. They knew about machines. They knew how to work them. And when they went to MIT or other places, they got a theoretical understanding, which broadened that. But today, engineering professors tell me their students don't know what a screwdriver is. They've never used a power tool. They are not at all able to make something. And so just a couple weeks ago, I was at MIT and gave a keynote for the International Symposium on Academic Makerspaces. And schools really around the world are looking at how do they reintroduce this kind of learning, which is often done independent outside of class or outside of a curriculum, because they see the value in it. They also see that students are very motivated and interested in this. And I think one of, and I'll close on this, is one of the real other sides of of this maker movement is it's, I think at its heart is broadening participation in innovation. Like how many new people can we get to think of themselves and to actually innovate, not just create Facebooks, but to innovate in a sense in a personal way, to change their life, to change their own Wi-Fi or to change something, to be able to do something themselves. And so that I think is where we are today. And what really interests me is getting lots of different people with different skills, combining them in new ways to solve some of the important problems we have in front of us. So I'd like to ask Robert to talk a little bit. I think Robert gave a talk at one of our conferences once on the origins of Geek Squad. And I loved the way, you know, that you thought about a wide range of problems and noticed the importance of building a fleet of cars and a fleet of people that could be deployed broadly.
Well, I feel like the prodigal son of Make Magazine who has come home. You know, if Make Magazine had like come out in 1978, I would have founded Geek Squad when I was, you know, 9 years old. Because, you know, I was born in 69, so I would go to the library, you know, a couple blocks from my house. And if I wanted to learn, you know, like if you wanted to do like rockets, you had to get all this gear. So I was always looking out for projects that I could do that, you know, didn't require too much equipment. And before Make Magazine, you had to hunt in the old Popular Mechanics. Like Popular Electronics were like committed circuit people, and I was like a shade tree mechanic. I would take crap apart. Like my original maker origin story is my parents went to go grocery shopping once, and they came home, and all the doorknobs and the springs in the doorknobs and all the screws were perfectly lined up on the dining room table. And, you know, there were two possible reactions to that, but I remember my parents being very proud for a while. Anyway, I always think about, too, like, my dad wasn't paying attention. I said, I'm going to take apart the TV. He's like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then, like, he realized it was, like, Sunday NFL, and he's like, you got 20 minutes to put that back together. That's when I learned to work under pressure. So yeah, Geek Squad is just an organized maker fair for fun and profit. Yeah. Last thing I'll say, and then we'll just kind of go back and forth, is I remember when YouTube first came out, because my entire career has been based on showing up at people's homes who already are angry and ready to throw the computer out the window. So there's fear. And then the name Geek Squad was meant to make people relax. It was also meant to lie to people because it was just me on a bicycle and calling myself a geek. Didn't really sound like a business. So I was like, oh, there's dozens of us. And there was like just me. And I want to make people relaxed. And, you know, you're in their home and you're talking to them. And they would always apologize to me. Oh, I feel so stupid. I would say, ma'am, don't be impressed by my knowledge. I only learned this stuff staying home 1,000 Saturday nights, not kissing girls. So, you know, you have your life, live it. But when YouTube first came out, I used to ask people in like 05, 06, and I'd ask people to raise their hands and say, how many of you in the last year have taught yourself something you've never done before just by watching a YouTube video? And a couple hands will go up, and then 06, 07, more and more hands. Now every hand goes up. And I think what's significant now, right? Because when I started Geek Squad, a geek became the world's richest person. That's when the tides begin to change for us, right?
Bill Gates.
Huh? Right. And then, you know, I feel like I played my little part in that. Now we've got Silicon Valley. Now all of you are geeks. You all have supercomputers in your pocket. So my work is done here. But I love the diversity of things. I remember hearing people say, oh, my window fell down in my back seat, and I had to learn how to take off this model of BMW on the door and get the window rolled back up. Somebody's like, my daughter, her brother shot a squirrel and she was, or a rabbit, and she was so horrified that she made him learn how to skin it and eat it so its death would not be in vain. And the point there is that, you know, people learn guitar, I hear people learn how to do makeup on YouTube, and this idea that people are learning how to learn.
Yeah.
And once you, you know, I got over my fear of taking the world apart by taking doorknobs apart and not having my parents beat me. And when people can play and not have fear, then once you learn how to learn, you can figure anything out. Like I had to like change the weather stripping of my garage door this weekend, and I was so proud of myself. I finally figured it out. And then I put the garage door down, and it was off by a quarter inch. And then I had to look up another YouTube video on how to like untension the spring thing. And this may not seem very important to you, but I still had this amazing epiphany. And so people are learning how to learn. Yeah. And now, well, there's no need for Geek Squad anymore. Well, as long as Silicon Valley keeps churning out all this crap, there'll be a need for Geek Squad. But, you know, what now? What, I mean, is everybody a maker now?
Well, we didn't see everybody raise their hand here, so there's a lot of work still to do. But I think you get to a concept that I think geeks were good learners, and they were largely self-taught. But also, in almost a contradictory way, they learned a lot from other people, like talking to other people, looking at what they were doing. And I think the point you make about YouTube is really a good one today, is that it's almost a substitute for, you know, finding that person who could show you how to solve a problem or how to do something. That in the past, I'd say if you grew up and you say, my dad had a shop and showed me how to use these tools, you kind of thought yourself as a maker. You were used to it. You were around it. But today, whether your parents do this or not, you can go on YouTube and figure these things out. And once you get over that fear that, you know, maybe I shouldn't do this or this isn't for me, you realize you can learn almost anything.
And you can pause it and you can rewind in the privacy. I think it's a very big thing because I was trying to learn how to tie a bow tie in London once, and I went and bought one, and it cost me like $100 for the stupid thing. And then I realized I was doing it wrong because the video was playing in the mirror backwards, so I had to like – anyway. But I could do it by myself, and you could pause and hit rewind, and then you don't feel stupid. You hear this over and over again. You know. Yeah. By the way, just a little sidebar in China. So when Geek Squad expanded into China with Best Buy, I said, hey, by the way, like – what's the word for geek in Mandarin? And they're like, well, there isn't one. And I'm like, these people invented paper and gunpowder. they're a nation of geeks. Right. So Geek Squad roughly translates in Mandarin to magic guest.
Guest.
I have trademarked for potential use one day, right? Which is actually a great name. Anyway, sorry for that diversion. But,
You know, they at Maker Faire Shendao, Maker has in China, the premier visited a makerspace in Shenzhen in 2015 and subsequently gave out a message that makers were entrepreneurs and China wanted more of them. So in Shenzhen, for instance, if you organize a group of people and find some space, they'll give you $50,000 to start a makerspace. In America, we're struggling to get anything like that. But it's kind of created the impression a little bit in China that makers are only entrepreneurs. And so they at this Maker Faire in China, they use the word Zao, Z-A-O, which had more sense of invention and fun and other things. And they were trying to kind of I think connected to what we think of as, in a sense, a playful maker.
Well, when you were talking earlier, I was thinking of, if you've learned about the concept of mirror neurons, they've discovered these now, that we have certain neurons. Like, so when a mother smiles at her baby, the baby is learning how to smile and reflect. So we first learn by copying, and that's another related thing to YouTube. And a great story I heard, I don't care whether it's true or not, but I think it is. Hunter S. Thompson, the famous writer, was like a groundskeeper down in Big Sur, I think at Ventana in the 60s. And there's a photo of him sitting like with a typewriter because he could write. He was alone for many months. And I heard a story that Hunter S. Thompson wanted to know what it felt like to write a great novel. So he typed out one of Hemingway's novels, like The Sun Also Rises. Now, that's not the same as creating a novel, but this idea that to get started and you have no idea what to do, you copy. So maybe your next pre-brand for makers will be called Fakers. So you don't have to worry about making anything. Just copy what somebody else does.
Fake it because until you make it, right?
That's right. You know, I would do that with my kids, right? You just help people do something And there's a line in the play, The Libertine, I rehearse and I rehearse and I rehearse until I'm free to act. Mm-hmm. So at some point, even if you're following a recipe, you know, about at the 8th or 10th time, it's like jazz. You can start improvising,
yeah,
right, and winging it.
So. And I think that's an important point. I kind of talked about it a little bit that a lot of things we publish in the magazine or a lot of things you find in Unstructables, you know, they're someone else's project. But like if you haven't built a potato cannon, building one is kind of fun, right? And it's not novel. It's not innovative. But when you build a lot of things like that, you also developing the capability to think about how things are built. And when you have your own idea, you begin to say, well, it's a little bit like that and a little bit like this, and I'll put the two together. So I think that the other thing that I heard about mirror neurons that I thought was fascinating is if a ballet dancer watches a ballet on television, her brain lights up in a different way than someone who has not done that, you know, is not a ballet dancer. So like the more you do things, the more aware you are, the more engaged you are in watching someone else do that. It's like your mind is really learning from that more, as opposed to just like I can, without any experience of doing it, understand what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I knew what I wanted to do when I was like 8 years old. I saw Star Wars. I want to be in computers or robots or whatever, you know. But, you know, I have 4 kids, and not all of them knew what they wanted to do when they were 8, and I tried to give them a lot of different experiences, and it's like, you know, what I like about the maker movement is it offers the ability for people to taste a lot of different things, and hopefully, you know, the more you do. I heard this thing the other day. Again, I don't even care if this story is true or not. It makes sense. It's true for me. Pottery class, and the teacher says to the class, all right, half of you will be graded on quantity. We will weigh the total weight of all the pots you make in the semester, and you'll be graded, and you know, A's will be at the top percentile. The other half of you will be graded on quality, and you have to have a perfect pot to get an A. And the story goes is at the end, the best quality pots were the ones that had made the most, that it doesn't really take any talent, right, that you just have to start somewhere, as ugly and messy. And so I'm interested to see over the next couple of decades, you know, because I personally feel that everybody in this room has amazing talents. And if I could create a summer camp for kids and adults, it would be to just increase the speed at which people bump into, you know, where they get their energy from.
Yeah. And just it sort of reminds me that – so I started Maker Faire because I was meeting makers through the magazine, and I thought they were fascinating people. But it was almost what you said there. When I thought of Maker Faire, I didn't just want the things they made to be on display. I wanted them. I thought when you looked in their eyes and you felt like what passion they had for what they were doing, that – that was something we don't get on television. We don't get in media typically. It was enthusiasm. It was their you know, their expression of themselves in the things they make and their interest in it. So Maker Faire really wanted it to be a chance for people to talk to others about this. So like, how did you learn to do that? Where did you get the materials? And in that way, to help other people think like that and become makers as well. Robert, you just moved up to Sonoma County, where I live as well, and talk about some of the projects that you've gotten yourself into.
I apparently moved to the mountains just in time. you know, I don't know. I got this property, and I decided to check out of society, and I found clay on my property, and so I'm going to build a pit kiln, and I build clay ovens. I took this class because I used to live in the Midwest, and you can't build clay ovens in the winter. You can't do anything in the winter. And so there was a class in Healdsburg, and we learned how to make you know, clay ovens out of cob, which is clay, sand, and straw. And fire is like my favorite first technology. Mm-hmm. It's just that humans came up with. Fire is amazing, right? Because it's living. And I don't know. You know, I'm we were just talking about, well, what's the difference, right? I'm creating my own personal wilderness. I'm learning things for the first time that people have known for thousands of years. And technology is like great. It makes life faster and more efficient. But baking bread, when you come to my house, what would you rather learn about? My automated lighting system? Or how about we eat this amazing bread I just cooked in this clay oven I built with my bare hands? Right? Yeah. See, I've been drifting more towards food. It's my favorite making right now, because it's just, if I want to fall in love and get context for anybody in any culture, I just have to ask them, tell me about food that means something to you, like a dish from your grandmother. And it's, I found the best way. So, but I'm doing a pit kiln because I found clay on my property. And then I learned that you can actually, if you just dig a pit and you stack some earthenware bowls in there, assuming you know how to make those, and then you build a fire on top and it sits there for 3 days and it turns into earthenware. And mm-hmm. I have to do this, and I blame Make Magazine.
Yeah, that's good. You know, I think one of the fascinating things is you really can learn to do anything online. You can find out information. But there's this point that I was trying to get at, is that you read about something, you watch a video, but to really learn, you have to do it. You know, you have to, you know, you can read the recipe all day long, but until you actually go through that process, and you mentioned like doing it 6 or 7 times, you become, you know, at some point you stop looking at that recipe, or you stop consulting that, you kind of know what you're doing, and that you feel different, you know, about that. You know, you have some confidence in what you're doing. The point I try to get is I actually think that what appealed to me about making was the same, like learning to do something that was hard, or learning to do something I'd never done before. It's very satisfying. I just think of at Maker Faire, when we open on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock, right? 10 after 10, there's a line of 100 people standing outside a learn to solder tent. And, you know, who would think people get up on a Sunday morning and say, I'm going to go somewhere and pay money and go in and solder? But it seems like a gateway. It's something that's kind of hard, or people didn't expect to do, but they're surprised to be able to do it. And I think that sort of opens the door for them to go and say, I could do this and I could do this. Of course, we all need the time to do these things, but we've been told a lot of times that we can't do something, or I think a little bit around technology that you need an expert to do that, or someone else. We can't figure it out for yourself. And I actually think the gating factor, particularly around technology, is how much time are you willing to put into something to solve it? You know, if the time is worthless to you, you don't want to spend much time. A geek looks at a technology problem as, oh, that's interesting. You know, I will put the time into learning because I'm going to see another one of those problems down the road. And I think that when you learn that way too, it's like I'd like to learn how to do that. Not that I want to become an expert in it, but it's one of many things, and somehow that's going to be useful or valuable to me down the road. And if nothing else, the learning itself, the fact that you're a good learner, is a product of it as well.
Well, think about like voice control these days. I mean, things are very, very moving very quickly in voice natural language processing. The Alexa is a very popular product. It's causing a lot of geeks to re-examine what we think of as input. And we've had speech for a while, but it's mostly been not very done very well. And if you've gone to a cocktail party, how many people have bumped into like every other person? I have an idea for an app, and they ought to make an app for this. And why do we all say that? Because most people don't know how to program an app. And most people don't know how to program. But I always say, if you know how to sketch out a set of rules on paper with pencil, then you can program. So there's this barrier right now. Like to learn music, you have to learn you have to go through these symbols. And to learn to program a computer, you have to learn this foreign language. But imagine the day when you would be able to talk to your phone and say, I want to make an app. And your phone comes back to you and says, well, what do you want it to do? And it begins to narrow you down. And then the computer interviews you for 3 hours. Well, what about this? Well, what if they hit this button? What color do you want that button to be? And I'd like to think in our lifetimes, because we talk about making, we think of physical things. Mm-hmm. But think about the ability in our lifetimes for non-technical people to just describe something and the ability to sketch an idea verbally and have the computer at least visualize it, maybe tell you where you could get it printed. Yeah. And think of all the makers that are dormant makers, right, that you've not mm-hmm. yet deputized, that are just waiting. And so we'll probably in the next 10, 20 years, we'll have to rethink our whole notion of what this community means.
Well, I think the other side that you're getting at too is just the collaborative nature of problem solving. If we can get a lot of different people together, we don't all have to have the same talents. Something I write about in the book is there's a place in Louisville, Kentucky called First Build that was started at GE Appliances. They wanted to create a maker space and invite makers in to solve problems related to household like appliances, washing machines, dryers, and ovens. And I went to – they had a hackathon. They brought about 200 people there for a weekend, industrial design students, engineers from GE, just an interesting group of people. And the winning project, which originally was created over 36 hours or so, was a induction oven for the visually impaired. And induction is sort of those cooktops that are kind of smooth. Well, they created recessed areas so you know where to, if you're blind, you could know where the pot goes. But the real innovation was they voice activated the oven. So someone could say, is the oven on? Is the left burner working? At what temperature? And to be able to interact with that oven differently. And one of the interesting views, I think, that particularly with Silicon Valley here, technology companies just generate technology because they can, right? They can make it faster, they can make it smaller, and to some degree make it smarter. But they don't often have a good idea of how that fits into our lives or why that benefit is important.
You know why, though?
What's that?
Why does a geek automate something? Because they can. That's the. That's what separates geeks from everybody else. We don't need a reason to do
that. But it's actually sort of an important point. Is one of the things we talk about a lot in the book is 3D printing. And I think geeks, early makers, were really interested in 3D printing, not like a consumer. A consumer says, what does that 3D printing do for me? A geek would say, I want one of those 3D printers so I can figure out what they're good for. You know, I want to explore that and solve it. And I think a lot of them did get into that way. And actually, if you go back to the early personal computers, for most of us in the 80s, we'd say, well, what do I need a personal computer for? We didn't actually have very good understanding of what uses are. And a lot of them said, well, I'm not interested in keeping my finances on a computer, so I really don't need one. Turns out that communication today is probably the biggest use of computers and media as well.
This is why I started the Geek Squad, to give this separate race of creatures a home, to practice their craft in peace and solitude. This is a race of creatures that they don't care about money. The only power they care about is low power consumption and longer battery life. They read manuals for things they don't even own.
Yeah.
You know. Now, there's an article this week, actually, MakerBot, which was one of the early consumer-grade 3D printers. And the article is why the 3D printing revolution never happened. I would argue it did happen. The company itself failed. But geeks don't care. That doesn't mean that it's not going to be a thing. It just means that it's going to take on a different life form. So my little 3D printing story is I was listening to a Radiolab story about this skull that sat in a drawer since the 1920s, and they thought it wasn't a human-related skull. There was a whole story about it. And they finally figured out it was related to us, about 6 million years old, and it had died a certain way. They did a forensic analysis, and it was fascinating. And at the end of the Radiolab story, they said, by the way, we have scanned this skull, and if you would like to print it out, to touch this and see it for yourself, now that I've got context in this story. So I found some local place, and for $20, somebody printed it out. And my wife won't let me let it just have the skull sitting out in the library in our house, but I have it on my desk, and I tell everybody. And this idea where an object that you hear a story about over the airwaves could then become physical as an artifact. Anyway, that's my 3D printing story.
It's fascinating. There's, you know, and it's interesting to see that these technologies find lots of applications. And we've written a couple of stories on this, but you know, one was a man whose wife was had a brain tumor, and you know, they did some treatment, and they, you know, they told them that it wasn't working and that they'd have to go in and operate, and you know, they're doing MRIs and looking at 2D scans of this. Well, he asked to get, you know, all the scans, and he created a 3D model of her brain, both what it was originally and what it was today. And he was able to prove to them that the tumor was shrinking, that the, you know, that they didn't need to do surgery. You know, and it reminds me also of a pediatric surgeon who, you know, he operated on hearts for young children. And they'd similarly do that scan. They started creating 3D models and printing them out. And before they did the surgery, they'd sit down as a team and understand, you know, what that problem was that they were solving and their method of solving it. So when we didn't have that, it was all in our head. And we all kind of thought we agreed, but we didn't know if we really did, because we're just looking at an image and interpolating something from that. So it really is one of the things I did write in the book about in that I find really fascinating is the way that making is in healthcare and other. We had a maker fair in Nepal for humanitarian purposes to bring makers together who are solving problems in developing countries. There's a lot of ways, apart from business, that making is having a lot of interesting impacts out there. Well, we're kind of up at almost a window here where I'd like to encourage people to ask questions. Elizabeth, are you going to conduct that? Or?
I want to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on the radio that we're listening to Dale Doherty in conversation with Robert Stevens. They are with us today on the subject of makers of innovation. I'll turn on the mic and we can welcome questions.
And if we don't know the answer, we will make one up. And we will fake it.
Okay. Hello, my name is Ben. I'm with an ed tech company called M2 Teach. I agree. I love, Dale, your new book and what you've started, and I think it's growing by leaps and bounds. But the future of makers and designers are women, yet our products are mainly designed by men. And I see this as a structural problem in that women buy 90% of everything or make the buying decisions of the products, even the tech products, the house, the car, and that everything's getting automated, programming, 3D printing, cloud to AutoCAD, that how do we – it's not a gigantic skills gap. It's a permissions gap for even small girls and women to say you don't need to know all these advanced skills, that you can actually be a inventor or a maker.
Well, you know, historically we pretty much excluded women from, you know, processes like engineering and invention, and I think we've started to change, but I think culturally it hasn't changed fully yet. But I you know, when I go to maker fairs and I see, you know, primarily I see families there, and I see girls as well as boys doing this, and I think. One of the things that makes me hopeful, anyway, is getting, you know, getting anybody involved in these sort of small practices, you know, doing these things to build up some confidence that you can do it. You know, and most women that are engineers that I talk to is basically I ask them, what can we do? And they say, don't do anything. You know, just stop telling us we can't do things, you know? And so a lot of them have been diverted away, like, that's not for you. And a boy might be saying, oh, good, keep it up. So, but I think a lot of it isn't just about what happens in school. It is what happens culturally and what happens in day-to-day lives. And when they're in there playing and enjoying and doing these things, they're kind of also trying out identities, right? And to see how, you know, other people recognize that and support it. Okay. So I'm hopeful, but I realize there's a pretty big challenge here. Next question.
A lot of the theme of the discussion is about these developing tools that will bring the capacity to make something to more and more people. I work in game design, so I've actually seen a lot of that trend developing where we have more and more game engines developed by people who have computer science PhDs that are then used by people largely with art backgrounds or with very limited yeah. programming background. What I'm kind of curious about is that going to ultimately create more and more of a divide where there's the people who use these tools and then there's this very small number of people who have, let's say, a comp sci PhD or an engineering PhD who are the ones creating these tools?
Well, let's take a case of Arduino. Okay, I think that's a pretty good example of an open tool that a fellow that was teaching interaction design at an Italian, you know, industrial design school comes up with to make it easier for his class of design students, artists, to create interactive projects. And he open sources the project, and you know, it begins to find all kinds of uses. And so I don't know that. You know, initially he has an elite background to be able to do that. I think he just saw a problem and did it. But there's real value in, as you talk about, like game engines. This is sort of a making engine, right? It's sort of the brains of a project, and the fact that we could all build projects and share knowledge about how to use that brain or how to use that engine is really, I think, the benefit here. That if we all had our own version of that, we'd never be able to talk to each other and say, well, how did you do that? And it doesn't matter whether you're an artist and I'm an engineer. We still have, you know, we might encounter similar problems, say, with Arduino, and we can go in a community and work those out. So I think there's probably always some set of – there's a percentage of people who are creating tools and there's others that are consuming them. But that creation of tools that other people can use – I mean, I have to say one of the reasons making is more prevalent today is because more of that expert knowledge is embedded in software. And so it may not take you 10 years to learn how to do something when you could go on a computer and draw a few squares and press a button and you send out to a 3D printer. I think it is a kind of a democratization of the technology, but also a democratization of learning to use that technology.
Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, says that Wikipedia is not just a democracy. It's they aim for consensus, but there is an aristocracy by category. There is also a monarchy. There are decision makers. I think fashion and music point some clues, right? I mean, there are designers who, you know, there's always going to be an elite and a need for an elite. But at the same time, like with music, I grew up in the 80s when a lot of people didn't think rap was a valid form of art, and now it's absolutely accepted. And so most gourmet food has its roots in peasant dishes. So it always goes through a cycle and an evolution. They call it frequency-dependent selection. And that's basically like if all the peacocks are green and one of the peacocks mutates into like blue feathers, all of a sudden, you know, the other birds are like, that's kind of attractive and different. And then everybody wants blue feathers. And so I call it the power of spite. I mean, we'll always have spite to mix things up in human civilization. So the minute anything becomes like the standard, then there'll be a way to do it. So you'll have technically trained or classically trained musicians, but there'll always be there continues to be new forms of music. And if you have not seen Kirby Ferguson's Everything is a Remix, I strongly recommend it online, and I think you'd like it. Everything is a remix. He just talks about how in some sense, there's no originality. Everybody's been stealing from everybody else. So if you're against the idea of elitism, you'll love this documentary.
Yeah. You know, it is sort of true. I think one of the things of being around creative people, having a culture where you see this, is it stimulates new ideas, new connections. And you know, a simple definition of creativity is seeing a connection between two different things and saying, you know, that makes sense to you, and no one has made that before. I always thought that, you know, we might have robots and we might have knitting at Maker Faires, but in one of them I saw a knitting robot that was sitting there, you know, doing that. And, you know, you get people thinking like that. And I always say, like, one of the problems in education in some ways is we don't actually expect the kids to be creative past the point. We don't give them the opportunity. And if you talk to teachers, well, if I ask them what they want to make, they won't have an answer. And I said, well, do you ever ask them? You know? Mm-hmm. And to some degree, when they don't have that, it's like being, whether it's YouTube or a magazine or being at an event, if they go look at what other people are doing, it inspires them. And one might like music, the other might like bicycles, and the other might like robots, but they start seeing that they can do stuff. And I say the most satisfying thing about the Maker Movement is actually to see kids engaged in it, that it doesn't really matter who they are, what their background is. And again, it's kind of funny I have to say that sometimes to parents and teachers, but they're kind of discovering that kids like to do this, and this is almost the easy way to go, is to let them have more control, give them access to tools and materials, and start helping them develop this practice.
There's one alternative, and that is one of my children, I did my best to get them into Star Wars and making, and they all just didn't take. But if you want someone to innovate, my son Connor, give him rules and constraints and tell him he can't do something. Yeah. Again, power of spite. Some people blossom when you tell them they can't do something. So if you've empowered somebody, you've given them plenty of blue ocean space to do something and nothing's happening, cut their budget in half, cut their time in a third, and you'll be amazed at what people can accomplish when you lock the door.
Well, I actually think that's, you know, on a global scale, I think that's why the developing world is going to be more competitive than a lot of the kids growing up in the, you know, in the developed world, that they will live and work under constraints that make them more creative, that make them, you know, more ingenious at solving problems. There's a story I tell in the book about one of the co-founders of Intel, Bob Noyce. The writer Tom Wolfe wrote a piece called The Tinkerings of Bob Noyce, I think in the 70s. And Wolfe was curious why sort of the greats of the information age, you know, computers and all that, you know, came from small towns in America, not large cities. And he went and, you know, gave us a bit of the history of a Noyce who grew up in Iowa, in a small town there, and came across transistors really early on in high school and everything. But Noyce, when he asked him that question, like, why in small towns? And he said, you know, when you grow up in a small town, you can't go buy something. You have to make it. You know, it doesn't exist, so you have to figure out how to do that. And I think that's that. You know, in some degrees, the absence of stuff, you know, makes you more creative than the abundance of stuff.
They say a recession is a terrible thing to waste.
What about going forward? What does that look like for the future then?
Yeah, well,
how does that inform us?
I think I've been particular since the election, trying to figure this out. You know, here's a popular movement of some sorts, not certainly as others. And there were ways that the Obama administration did some really good things to recognize the Maker Movement, but I also feel like they didn't do enough to actually make it real, to bring it into cities and help people who really needed, you know, to develop new skills, that needed to be able to understand what the world is becoming and how they could participate in it. So I've been thinking that when, you know, both for the existing makers that we have and for others, that that part of what is attractive about the maker movement is a sense of belonging to something, of being a part of something that is having positive impact on the world. And this sounds kind of crazy, but on my trip back from China, I was watching the Star Trek movie on the plane. And I thought, wow, that is so interesting. You know, this idea of being, you know, on a spaceship and having a mission and going somewhere, you know, to solve a problem or do something. And so I've been noodling around this idea of missions for makers, you know, of just how could we all get together and decide on some of those missions and actually work across different groups and really get to the future that way, as opposed to complaining or, you know, just protesting or doing this. Like, how can we as communities begin to solve our problems better than we have? We have plenty of problems, but we don't have enough people working on solutions. Robert, your own thoughts?
Well,
future.
The future. I was thinking of something while you were talking. I'm trying to remember what it was. Google has ruined my memory. Twitter's my short-term memory, and Google's my long-term memory now.
Well, I'm wondering when you say that about finding each other and communicating in groups, whether some of the work that you've been doing around platforms, messaging platforms, for example, does that help us to find each other or to communicate about projects like this?
Well, just MySpace that I'm in is really just trying to eliminate the call center being on hold. I mean, I'd rather text the call. I'm just trying to get where you can text your bank and your airline instead of having to, like, verbally call them, because it's just about giving people more choices on how they get stuff done. But I guess I would just say real quickly is I was used to be in art school, but I left because it was 1989 and the Berlin Wall had just fallen. And it was like the metaphorical wall had fallen. Like, mm-hmm. anything is music and anything is art. And on one hand, the Cold War was over and the borders are gone, but borders create definition and they create identity. So it's always a swing. While some of us are more troubled than others these days going forward, great art is usually created in very tough times, and I feel like the world we're entering, the upside at least is that people, when we're comfortable, we tend to create less, right? So I'm optimistic at least that the tools will continue, regardless of your political environment. The technology, you know, I think we're in this because it helps give the hope that the average person can do more with less. And that doesn't ever stop. That wheel keeps turning. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that, you know, my father grew up in the Depression, so I always heard about how tough it was, but they seem pretty happy. So struggle is an important part of that, and I'm just excited. You know, I still feel like there's a big barrier between what people think they can do and what they're actually capable of, and I'd like to get that gap closed more and more every day.
Yeah. I think that's a great way. I mean, I believe the maker movement isn't all the way there. And even the tools and things, there's still lots of opportunity. But it is empowering to understand that you can realize an idea, that you know what to do with it, and that a lot of people have them. And I think they dismiss them. They don't know how to get them started. And it's not any different than an artist looking at a blank canvas or a writer looking at a blank page and saying it's not really worth my putting anything on that. You know, you kind of just have to start. You have to do that. And you may not like what you do initially, but then you may get to a place where you're okay with what you're doing and you realize you're growing and you're changing and you're getting better at it. And I think that's, in many ways, I'd like to see that's the kind of education we're offering kids more, is less judgment by testing and more encouragement of them discovering their own talents. Like Robert said in an offhand way, but, you know, I just think about it. But think about the people that end up dropping out of school and it's 10, 15 years later, you know, that they discover who they are. Well, what if school was that place that actually fostered and supported who they were? So they didn't have to drop out. But they got, perhaps we got benefit as a society of those talents much earlier. you know, and we had ways of, and I think, again, the promise of America really should be that we believe talent is everywhere, not just in that elite group or the people that go to the best schools. And I, again, I think this is what I find so satisfying about the maker movement, seeing makers who, you know, they didn't go to MIT. They didn't go to Georgia Tech. But they're the people doing it. They're creating things and making things and teaching that to other people because it means something to them and they value it.
You know, I think it's appropriate now to clarify the first two principles of the maker movement as I understand them. The first one is, and the audience can probably complete this thought, anything that can be assembled can be disassembled. And I used to have a T-shirt you gave me once that says, if you can't take it apart,
you can't open it, you don't own it.
If you can't open it, you can't own it. That's right. If we can just get people to take the world apart and take their world apart, then I think we'll be in a good place.
I think that's a good thought. Well,
I wanted to thank you for this time and to tell you thank you also. I love soldering, thanks to the maker movement.
I love kombucha too. So.
So thanks to Dale Dougherty and to Robert Stevens for your comments here today. We also thank our audience here in the club, as well as the radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.